Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about Wisconsin's public lands to start the show today. And we'll also take a look at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources' latest atlas that really helps us out when it comes to finding those public lands. And great to have Jim Lemke with us. He is the real estate section chief at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Let us know how you use public lands, perhaps, or what's your favorite state park. Questions about the atlas. Maybe the volunteer work. Do you do some volunteer work on our state's public lands? A lot of people do. Maybe tell us which public lands are most important to you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Jim Lemke, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's really exciting to be here. And of course, it's exciting to be talking about something as fun as the Wisconsin Public Access Atlas. So that's it's great to have that opportunity to talk to you.
You know, we talk about public lands. Let's maybe start with a definition. What do you mean when you say public lands?
Well, pretty much just basically what the definition says. These are lands that are available and open for the public to use 24 hours a day, whether it's for hiking, hunting, trout fishing, a number of different uses, cross-country skiing, ATV uses. These are lands that are your lands, the state of Wisconsin lands, and they're available for the public to use at their discretion.
And we've got a lot of lands, and we've got, we have federal, we've got state, we've got local government lands, and together it adds up to quite a bit.
It really does. In fact, the Atlas, which was mandated by state law, actually, Larry, for the legislators back in 2011, really dealt with lands that the Department of Natural Resources purchased with stewardship monies. And we've grown this Atlas to include all public lands in the state of Wisconsin. So not only lands that the DNR manages and owns and has responsibility for, but the national forest, the county forest, the Bureau of Commission of Public Lands are available for public use as well. So within this atlas, we included all those available properties. So it's really become inclusive atlas and resource for people that want to get out and enjoy the outdoors.
I had a lot of fun going through it. You mentioned we've federal, state, local. How do they manage them similarly, or they all have their kind of, each agency has its own way about doing things?
Actually, very similarly, because the resources are very similar. So you're talking about managing tall forest and clean waters and timber lands. And so actually there's a lot of cooperation that goes on between our federal partners, our county partners, and the state itself. And they rely a little bit on the biologists at the DNR, which help facilitate the management of some of those properties. But it's a very cooperative effort. And I think, as you're suggesting, it's very consistent across some of those different landscapes.
Yeah, absolutely. Questions and comments coming in already, but I want to, just before we go to the phones or take emails here, let's talk a bit more about this atlas. Earlier this month, the 2024 Public Access Lands Atlas became available, and I had a chance to go online and go through it. It is a dandy. But talk about what you can find in this latest atlas.
Yeah, that sounds great, Larry. So actually, there's two different ways of viewing the atlas. There's a published atlas in a written form that people can purchase, and that is quite an extensive book, almost 2 inches thick. If you can imagine, Larry, 4 million acres of land that's open and available to the public requires quite a bit of information. But the interactive part, as you suggest, is probably the most popular use of the atlas, and that'll show you where to find a class one trout stream, for example, or it'll tell you where you can put in your boat, whether it's a wilderness boat landing or whether it's a ramp with parking that's available. Where are the other trails that you could use for the Ice Age Trail, for example? That's all part of the atlas. And of course, some of the more common areas that we know about are state parks, which are very popular. Those are all part of this atlas. So you could discover Wisconsin. I mean, isn't that the tagline that comes along with our state? You can discover Wisconsin without leaving the confines of your computer or your coffee table book with the atlas.
I tell you, I went on the online to it, and I just thought, okay, I'll give it a test. And so there's a bar, you say a county. I put Dane County in, distance from the location, and I put Madison as a location, and then it offers several options. I just picked 25 miles, but it, you know, it goes to the hundreds of miles away from the thing. I picked 25 miles, and then it gives a whole list of what kind of activities are. Check on those. So I just checked on fishing, and then it says, you know, go ahead and click, and bang, up popped. Oh, I also said state parks.
Sure.
I just specified that. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 state parks pop up
yes.
within 25 miles of Madison.
And I've talked to people in the past that have questions on how to use the Atlas, as well as our real estate team has. And, you know, that a lot of people plan their weekends around this Atlas. If they're going to Viroqua, Wisconsin, or they're heading off to Manitowoc, they'll take out their interactive mapping and they'll review that area just like you did for Dane County, and they'll discover some hidden gem that they want to go out and explore with their family or by themselves or with their dog or whoever. And it just turns out to be a very popular resource we're pretty proud of at the DNR.
You should be. Ron, and well, just before that, there's a DVD available. I think it's $5.95, which is pretty cheap. You can get the whole book for $104 or something like that. But you can also download county maps for free, PDF. And then the online mapping application that we were talking about is free as well.
Yeah, the online mapping application, which is the most popular, that's
yeah.
free. And you can use that at any time, and there's no cost to do so.
Ron in Wolf River, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for taking this call. You know, Jim is a very humble servant of the people of the state of Wisconsin. Him and his colleagues at the Wisconsin DNR, including Ron Gropp and many others, just completed the Pelican River Forest Conservation Easement with their colleagues at the United States Forest Service. I mean, this thing is going to benefit everybody in Wisconsin. It's going to provide timber and fiber for the entire state, but also recreation for everybody who comes up north. Almost 70,000 acres conserved by these gentlemen. So really great job, you guys. Thanks so much for helping Wisconsin out.
Ron, thank you so much for calling. Comment.
Yeah, so Ron's referring to the largest forest legacy easement ever acquired in one acquisition by the state of Wisconsin, which is basically located up near Rhinelander, Larry, mm-hmm. for a viewpoint of where that is. And that will be lands that will be shown on this public access or atlas, excuse me. It'll take a little bit after we verify the acreages, but I imagine in the next 4 months that'll be one of the newest and latest additions, including the vehicular roads that people can use on this 70,000 acres. And that'll all be part of the atlas, which is updated, by the way, every 2 months so that it's current, so it's not outdated.
That's great. Ron, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Kent in Monona will give you a chance. Hi, Kent.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call today. I had a question for your guest. I'm an avid air gun enthusiast, and I want to know if there's any kind of restrictions or the legality of hunting small or medium game with some of the higher powered or even larger caliber air rifles that are available, because they've increased in power quite a bit recently over the last few years.
All right, thanks for calling. Jim, maybe out of your area a little bit, but perhaps not.
Well, I think it's out of my area a little bit, Kent, but thanks for the question. And I think that's probably a better question for our wildlife program. Our wildlife program, which is a bureau within the DNR, deals with hunting and hunting regulations. And Kent brings out a great point, especially with air guns and some of the changes that are coming with air guns and the allowable uses. One of the things the Atlas does do, Larry, it does tell you where you can hunt and where you can't hunt as far as the public access part of that is concerned. Always pay attention to the signs out of the property, because sometimes those do change. But that's probably a pretty good question for our wildlife program. And I'll talk to my colleagues over there and just make sure that they're on top of that subject, which I know they are. We've talked about it before. I just don't have the specifics of that. So sorry about that, Kent.
I'll bring that up the next time we have somebody from there, from that unit on the show for sure. Thanks, Kent, for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Gary called, couldn't stay with us. He's heard that changes are coming to Mendota County Park in Middleton. Wondered if you knew anything about that.
Yeah, so some of those individual questions on county parks are tough to answer because although we're interactive with them and we have partnerships with management and consultation with those county parks, what a county does with their individual parks is primarily up to them. What we'll make sure to do is if it includes expansion of the park or contractions of the park because maybe it's gotten smaller, and if those uses on that county park affect those that we have indicated within the Atlas, Larry, we'll be able to stay in touch with the county and make sure that we appropriately represent that in the Atlas. But, yeah, there's a lot of county parks out there and a lot of different uses, so it is a bit of a challenge to stay as current as we can. But I appreciate Gary bringing this question forward because now it's on my radar a little bit, so I'll pay attention perhaps better than I am this morning. But I'll pay attention to that particular subject and hopefully can provide some direction going forward.
In relation to Gary's question, here's what Clara found on the park's website. In August of 2022, the Foundation for Dane County Parks accepted a philanthropic gift of $1.5 million to replace the existing shelter and fix the pathways and parking. Parking lot lighting, reconstruction of the parking lot areas, replacement of existing playground with an accessible and inclusive playground, and installing new paved walking trail with benches and fitness nodes along the trail. So that's pretty cool, but I think the philanthropic part of it is, does this come into play very much in your bailiwick? Jim?
Actually, it really does. And, of course, we're appreciative of all those donations, whether it's land or whether it's cash for management purposes. But Wisconsin has a strong history of conserving these wonderful properties that we have throughout the state. And so there's a lot of people that have an interest in leaving a legacy behind, whether it's through donation or whether it's through land. So we deal with that quite a bit, and those appear before our Natural Resources Board as approval objects or items for them to approve. And donations, I bet you, Larry, in the course of a year, we accept 10 to 12 donations of just land that come through the real estate section. So it is a very popular way for people to make their mark on conservation in the state of Wisconsin. And we appreciate every one of those. And I am the contact, by the way, for any of those land donations. So people can always reach out to me after Larry's show, and I'd be happy to talk with them about land donations for the state of Wisconsin.
Jim Lemke, our guest today, he's the real estate section chief at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, as we talk with him about the new Atlas and all of the Wisconsin's public lands are in the newest Atlas. And we're talking about management and of course, acquisitions with him as well. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the 2024 Public Access Lands Atlas with our guest today, Jim Lemke, Real Estate Section Chief of the Wisconsin DNR, and of course talking about our public lands that we have here in the state, about 4 million acres, I believe, Jim mentioned earlier. Mary in Northlake has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I was reminded of the book I'm reading right now. It's Crossings. Goldberg is the last name of the author, and I think I heard about it on your show.
Yeah.
But anyway, your guest mentioned roadways going across this land, and I'm just wondering, after reading the book and finding that wildlife gets cut off a lot by roads, and of course we know roadkill is a big problem, I wondered if there are going to be any wildlife overpasses or underpasses on any of these roads across this beautiful property.
Yeah. Ben Goldfarb was the author of the book you're talking about there, Mary. And, well, what do you think, Jim? Anything like that planned in any of the public lands that we have?
Yeah, it's a really important question Mary's asking. And again, we deal with the real estate side of things, Larry, so don't have a whole lot of experience with roadways. Most of the properties that we do acquire that are new, we're very diligent in laying out roads for vehicular access or snowmobile access or whatever access might be available to the state. And I know our wildlife biologists and our fish biologists always take a look at those road concerns, not only from the impact it could have with crossing species crossing those roads, but also the impact it could have on wetlands and other areas. So I know it's something the department pays an awful lot of attention to. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of experience in this particular area. I know the DNR doesn't build a lot of roads into some of these properties. We utilize existing trails, existing roadways, so hopefully there's not new roads that are really in contrast to the protection of wildlife, which, of course, is a primary goal and mission of the department.
You know, Mary's question made me think about maintenance of public lands, and not just the roads, but everything else. And maintenance could be a big deal.
Well, it really is. Maintenance is really one of the arguments and one of the considerations when it comes to acquiring property. First of all, we have to have the means in order to maintain that property at some level, whether that's just natural reforestation of the property or natural communities of plants coming back into the area. Controlling invasive species, Larry, is a really big deal with our programs at the department, and that comes along with a cost, and there's a lot of management that comes to that we have to have a management plan in place for our Natural Resources Board that they want to hear about prior to the acceptance of acquisitions in the state. So it is a primary function. You began the program by talking a little bit about some of the friends groups that are out there that support our activities in the state. We would depend on those friends groups for a lot of different purposes, trail development, but also for management and care of those properties. They're the stewards of the lands. They live in those areas, and so management is a really key component, and like Mary's talking about, road development is part of that, but management of our resources is something that we have to pay very close attention to.
Ben in Hastings, Minnesota has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ben.
Hi. So I was wondering, are off-road motorcycles allowed on ATV trails? And if so, what do they have? Is it the same permit as an ATV?
Yeah, that's going to be specific, Ben, to the ATV trail itself. And that will be a part of the Pale Atlas. If you click on the identity button or identify button within the Atlas on the interactive part, it'll tell you allowable uses. And so it really depends on each particular road and each particular trail. I know that some trails allow for those types of activities provided they stay within the designated trails themselves, but it is a kind of on a case-by-case basis, which also brings the point, Larry, if you don't mind me pointing out, that the Atlas really does give you an oversight of what uses are available on these properties. But signage on the lands is very key, and those signages can change depending on the seasons and depending on the uses. But Ben, it's a good question that you're asking about off-road motorcycles or different types of uses. And all I could tell you is check with your local DNR authorities and experts and the counties, if it's county lands, to make sure that that's a permissible use on that land. And that would be my best advice.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the call. But take a look at the Atlas, because I think it'll help you get started in your, looking at what's available.
Yeah, it does, Larry. In fact, there's a button if you start to explore the Atlas, and I would encourage people to go on the Google search or wherever you go on, just type in DNR public access lands, and up the interactive map will become. You can click on that and you can start to explore some of those different opportunities in the state of Wisconsin. And there's a lot of different searches that you can really undertake on that Atlas, as Larry started to talk about. But there's one button, Larry, that's at the top of the menu that is called Identify. And if you click on that, it gives you a little cursor that you could click on any road or any boat landing or any type type of property, it'll give you further information. And like Ben is asking, available uses. And if you click on that, it'll tell you those uses on the property. It's not all inclusive, and it's always subject to change a little bit, but at least it starts to give you a head start into what you can and can't do on those properties. So I think a very important feature of the Atlas.
Marilyn emailed us and wonders, are state natural areas included in the Atlas?
Yeah, thanks, Marilyn. That's probably something I should mention. So thanks for the great segue. The state natural areas are included in the Atlas, and they do have their own special coded legend that not only indicates what are state natural areas, Maryland, but it'll also indicate what state natural areas are open for public use, because some of those state natural areas are protecting some sensitive geological features. They're protecting some sensitive species that are rare or endangered. So there are closed state natural areas. Most of them, I think you'll find, will be open, and there's special considerations, as you might know, to state natural areas. But those are all on the Atlas, and you'll be able to find those with just a click of a button, I think, fairly easily.
Thanks for that question, Marilyn. Rick in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, so thanks for taking my call. Sure. First, I'd like to thank your guests and the DNR, and for that matter, Governor Evers and very many people for the Pelican Forest Project that recently concluded. I live here in the Northwoods by Rhinelander and hope to enjoy that that piece of property, and I'm glad to see it's going to be a productive timber harvest forest. But my specific question is in regard to funding of the DNR. Now, there's a lot of aging hunters like me that are slowly dying off, and I understand that the younger folks are not buying hunting licenses and fishing licenses in sufficient numbers to adequately fund the DNR and to provide for some of those projects you've been talking about. I was wondering if your guests had any ideas about alternate funding sources for those of us who enjoy the woods for other things like bird watching, hiking, sure. You know. Cross-country skiing. What does he have any ideas of how we could do that?
Yeah, thanks for calling, Rick.
Yeah, Rick, it's really a timely question that you ask, or a subject that you raise, because just recently I was in a natural board, resources board meeting, and this very subject was talked about as far as some of the hunting licenses and the sports fishing licenses being reduced a little bit in the state because of usage. And all I can say on this subject, again, it's not an area that I'm that familiar with, but having just sat through that presentation, they are already looking at that, and they are forecasting at the DNR what that might look like in 10 years and how we can continue to raise funding necessary, not only for the maintenance and the continued support of those natural resources that we already own, but also to make sure that there's money available for some additional acquisitions that are still necessary in the state of Wisconsin. So I'm glad you brought it up so that it's on everybody's ears. And I can only say that it's something that the DNR is very attentive to. And I think we're going to see some unique ways of creating funding in the state that's going to help, you know, protect the natural resources that we already own.
Yeah, Rick, thank you so much. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, number 800-642-1234, or you can email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Seth in Dodgeville says the lower, just commented, the lower Wisconsin Riverway is amazing and a beautiful playground for anyone wanting to get out. Isn't that lower Wisconsin Riverway is absolutely amazing.
It really is, and thanks, Seth, for the promotion on the lower Wisconsin. The lower Wisconsin many years ago really had quite a bit of emphasis on land acquisitions and really took front and center stage when it came to not only acquiring lands along the lower Wisconsin, but also protecting some of those unique bluff lands that overlook the Wisconsin and the scenic beauty that comes with that. And when you hop a canoe and you tend to float or paddle down the Wisconsin River, the lower Wisconsin River especially, as Seth is suggesting, you can look up at these bluff lands and you can see all these bluffs that are undisturbed with development and housing and left in a natural scenic view. And That's all part of the Lower Wisconsin Riverway mission from many years ago that we continue today. And Seth, it's one thing that I take a close look at as real estate section manager. I pay attention to the resources that we have to acquire properties in the state of Wisconsin. And when all of a sudden the Lower Wisconsin Riverway pops out as an opportunity for us to be able to acquire lands or to protect more lands or protect some of the scenic beauties of those lands, it gets my attention and goes right to the top of that acquisition list because it remains a priority for this governor. It remains a priority for our administration. And as you suggest, nothing better to protect than that unique Lower Wisconsin River that everybody enjoys so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you can feel almost all by yourself sometimes, depending on the time of year or day of the week or whatever it is.
Yeah, I would encourage anybody to get out and hop in a canoe or a kayak or a boat and explore the Wisconsin River, the Lower Wisconsin River. And the Atlas, Larry, will tell you where you can put that canoe in and where you can park your car and where you can even camp on the Lower Wisconsin River. So don't forget to take your Atlas with you.
There you go. Oh, man. Scott emailed us. He's a member of the Friends Group for Plum and Pilot Islands. They're volunteers partnering with the National Fish and Wildlife Service to restore and maintain historic structures on the Green Bay National Wildlife Refuge. And he says, it's a joy as a volunteer, and work days always end with time to explore the island, and there's a swimming beach in case you work up a little sweat.
Yeah, so thanks, Scott, because I live in Green Bay. Well, Seymour, Wisconsin, to be exact. Now, grew up in Green Bay, so I just made a note on my pad here to check out Plum and Pilot Island and especially the swimming beach with all my grandkids now, Larry. So I appreciate the tip coming from you.
Thank you very much. Bill in Green Bay emailed us, why is it you can't have dogs in state natural areas?
So state natural areas are treated a little bit different than other areas of the state of Wisconsin. And those natural area designation come for a reason. And the reason usually is unique habitat that's within those state natural areas. And unfortunately, the ability to be able to control dogs off leash is a concern for the protection of those species. And so it depends a little bit as well on the designation bill of that state natural area, because I know you can have dogs in some state natural areas. They do require leashes in certain parts of it. Again, it goes back to a little bit of research and responsibility on the land owner's part to user's part to make sure that whatever their intended use is in compliance with the department rules and in compliance with county rules as it may apply. But basically, it's for the protection of habitat and species, and that's why you limit the ability to have dogs run off-leash on state natural areas.
Yeah, very good comment. Thank you so much for that. What percentage of Wisconsin's land is considered public? Well, I've tried to do the math on this, but I don't know the total acres of Wisconsin, so...
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I had an answer for you. But it's probably not as high as you might think when you start talking about 1.6 or 7 million acres of DNR and public-owned lands as a composite of the entirety of the state of Wisconsin. Larry, I think it's a smaller percentage than we might imagine.
Somebody else was wondering, how does it compare to other states? Are we good when it comes to other state? Do we compare well? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's another great question, and I actually have researched that a little bit. I don't have those statistics in front of me, but when it comes to Michigan, lower and upper Michigan, and it also comes to Minnesota, we're pretty comparable. We don't lead them as far as the number of acres or the percentage of acres that are owned by the state or in public use. But at the same time, we're not lagging far behind either. So it really is an equivalent figure, I would say, Larry. I don't think there's much advantage to either state as far as a noticeable difference. I think we're comparable to our neighboring states.
A question came up about landlocked public. We do have parcels of public land that are landlocked, do we not? And how do you manage, how do you make them accessible and so forth?
Well, that's an interesting point. So landlock is a part of definition. So a lot of lands that the state of Wisconsin owns and the people of the state of Wisconsin own are accessible via waterways. So technically, that's not a landlocked parcel when you can access it, and a lot of people do access state properties via canoe or via fishing boats of some sort. So technically, landlocked from vehicular use or even landlocked from hiking or foot traffic is different than the pure definition where you might be able to get at it with a boat. But years have gone by in the state through Act 20. Many years ago, Larry, we took a look at landlocked parcels that were not accessible either by boat or by foot. And we actually had an effort out there at that time to dispose of some of those properties, really led by our state legislators. And it was an attempt to take some of those lands and to sell them when they weren't accessible to the public. There is no way to create accessibility. If it's landlocked, you can't impose upon private landowners to find an access to the land. So it'll remain landlocked. But we did manage to sell quite a bit of those properties to neighboring property owners, and that money and those revenues were actually used to pay off some state debt. So it was a win-win directed by our legislators. I thought it was a great move on their part. It was called Act 20, and we continued at that time to dispose of a number of landlocked parcels. And I don't think, Larry, there's a high number of them that really exist in the state anymore.
Oh, good to know. What about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program? Maybe talk a bit about that and how it relates to our public land funding.
Yeah, sir. Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that because that's really been the funding arm for purchasing state properties. And it began back in 1989, was the first initiation of the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program, with our first acquisitions coming in 1990. So that's, gosh, Larry, what is that, 30 years now we've had the benefit of using Knowles-Nelson to acquire properties in the state that fit in with specific project boundaries of interest for the department that had public interest to them as well. So there has to be some financial component to be in order to go out and purchase lands. And the Knowles-Nelson, through bonded funds many years ago, provided that access and that avenue for us. And back in the 1990s, I mean, these were funds that were in the $20 million annual figures or so. Now it's been reduced through legislation, and appropriately, so it's down to closer to $5 and $6 million. And then those funds are still available for the state to buy properties in easement, to buy properties in fee for public use, but to really be more selective in what those properties are. Legislators appropriately want us to buy properties near population centers, so we really concentrate on some of those areas. And we also concentrate on areas that really help fill in, if you can, existing state ownership. So it improves access, so it allows us to manage properties easier. So those are what we currently use Knowles-Nelson for, and we appreciate those funds. And Knowles-Nelson is going to be up for reauthorization in another year and a half, so it's going to be a discussion that I think you're listeners begin to tune into and begin to pay attention to. Where are we going with stewardship? Not only for the real estate program that acquires easements and fees, but also it's a big part of our grants program is the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program, and that is well-funded, and those are monies that counties and nonprofit organizations can use not only to acquire properties, expand existing parks that they have, but they can also use it for facilities improvements, which is a big portion of Knowles-Nelson, and that's all made available to the insights back in the 1990s and continues to be just a great avenue for supporting recreation in the state of Wisconsin and conservation of lands as well.
Kind of like the fact that Warren Knowles was a Republican governor of the state of Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson, a Democrat senator for the state of Wisconsin, and both men really had the interests of the state's environment in their minds. And the fact that it was a Democrat and a Republican on that
Yeah, that's a great point. And just imagine, Larry, if you take a look at it and if you had the chance to do research all the properties and projects that were bought since 1990 with Knowles Nelson funding, it's changed the shape of Wisconsin. It's changed the $9 billion recreational industry in the shape of Wisconsin. And a lot of that can be pointed right back to Knowles Nelson's back in the 1990s. So the impact in the state of Wisconsin through this initiative has been far-reaching. And the other beautiful thing about it is it's perpetual, so it'll be that way forever.
Forever. It's what a wonderful thing. And maybe you've talked a bit about this, but bears repeating, how can someone listening get involved with the conservation and stewardship of our land, public lands?
Yeah, that's a good question, and not only from the standpoint that we need support, you know, from the local communities, but also for people to be able to engage in that type of activity is extremely valuable. So I would say get involved in your own neighborhood. That's part of the value and the beauty of Wisconsin lands is that everybody can, within just a short distance, find some public lands, whether it's state-owned by the people or whether it's county-owned. They can find lands within their own neighborhoods that they can become involved in. And maybe that's just a cleanup effort in the spring to pick up some of the litter that's left over from winter. Or maybe it's trail development, like the Ice Age Trail requires a lot of participation from their friends group. And they actually develop trails in support of that National Scenic Trail, which is extremely popular and important in the state. But that would be my thought, Larry, is look within your own community and reach out and see what involvement you can have, especially since there's a selfish standpoint. It's land you probably use a little bit more often, so might as well put your efforts in areas that you will personally benefit from.
And I want to go back, too, before we wind up, to the 2024 Public Access Lands Atlas, which is really a dandy. But again, just give us the short version of this and how do people get a copy of it?
So there's two uses of it, Larry, or opportunities for purchase. You can go to the UW bookstore. That's where you can purchase the written copy of the PAL Atlas, and that's $104.95. They don't have them sitting on the shelf because they like to print them because the Atlas changes every day, and we keep current with that. The other opportunity is just to go to Google Bar and search in Wisconsin Public Access Lands, and the interactive mapping will show up as a link. Click on that link, start exploring what available opportunities there are in the state of Wisconsin. You can't hurt the interactive mapping, so you can play along with it as much as you want, and I think you'll find it an enjoyable way of passing maybe some winter months in preparation for spring and summer months coming.
And you mentioned this earlier, but if you want, maybe there's somebody listening with the kind of land that the private land, and they would like to give it to the perhaps donate it to the state, and you said you're the guy. How do people get in touch with you?
So they can check out my email. It's james.lemke, L-E-M-K-E, so james.lemke@wisconsin.gov. And Larry, do you mind if I just give a quick shout-out to my team? I mean, Ann Scott has really led this effort and has for many years for the PAL Atlas, and she was joined with Kathy Schubach, who's a GIS specialist, and Jamie Tuhill as well, GIS specialist, and Lily Chase is new to the DNR, and what a fantastic team, and I would be remiss if I didn't pass along my thank you to them for all the hard work that they put into the PAL Atlas.
Absolutely, and I've used the Atlas already, and I'm finding it very valuable and also very easy to use. And I want to thank you so much, Jim, for taking time to be with us today. We'll have to get you back and do this
again. Well, I enjoyed it. You're easy to talk with, and what a great subject to talk about, right?
Jim Lemke, Real Estate Section Chief at our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Take a look at that Atlas. I believe we have a link to on the Larry Mueller Show page. If you go to today's date, and you'll find a link there. But if you can just type in 2024 Public Access Lands Atlas, and it's going to pop up. Well, wetlands on our minds as well today on the show. I'm looking forward to talking about wetlands with a couple of guests, Katie Belfus and Nelson Hamm. Next. I'm Larry Mueller. There are more than 5 million acres of wetlands in Wisconsin, and today we're kind of going about uncovering the story of how many of these wetlands were formed. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us. We're also going to talk about the annual Wisconsin Wetland Science Conference as well with our guests. And one of the guests with me in the studio, Katie Belfus, is back with us. She's the outreach programs director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And Katie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
So great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
With us as well by phone is Nelson Hamm, a professor of geology and environmental science in St. Norbert College in De Pere. Nelson's going to be presenting at this year's conference about wetlands and the late ice age. He'll be talking about wetlands in the late ice age. Nelson Hamm, welcome. Thank you for joining in.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to having you with us. So as we listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Do you live near a wetland? Maybe you have one on your property. What do you want to know about? Maybe how it came to be. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Katie, let's start with you. When's the conference this year?
The conference is February 20th to 22nd. We're going to be up in Green Bay, Ashwaubenon to be precise, at the Oneida Hotel and Convention Center there. And looking forward to it. It's the 29th annual conference that we've hosted.
That's a nice conference center. Yeah, that's a great place. And you kind of move that around.
We do. We deliberately move it to a different city every year in Wisconsin so that we can both be more convenient to different folks in our community from year to year, and also showcase and highlight wetlands and wetland conservation work that are happening in those different regions of the state. So it keeps it interesting.
And the theme this year?
The theme this year is great water. Great wetlands make great waters.
Ah, tell us more about
that. Well, without wetlands, wetlands are so important in our water cycle for keeping our waters clean and for providing habitat for a lot of the creatures that we might think of as water habitat folk, you know, fish and whatnot. But the wetlands are the estuaries, the places where a lot of the reproduction and the nursery happens for those species. And of course, up on the landscape, wetlands are those places on the landscape where nature intends water to go as it works its way through the watershed. So without healthy wetlands in our watersheds, we don't have healthy watersheds downstream. We don't have healthy water bodies downstream. So super, super important for the quality of our waters.
So if you're a first-timer attending the conference, what are you going to find? What can you expect to find?
You can expect to find 2.5 days of content about what's happening with wetlands, from the sort of 101 level, a very basic intro kinds of information, all the way through very complex ideas. We have two symposia happening at the conference this year, but workshops on plant identification, how to identify sedges, which is a very particular kind of plant, many of which grow in wetlands. We have an ash basket weaving workshop this year.
Oh, cool.
Because ash is a tree species that grows in wetlands. Unfortunately, we're losing a lot of those to emerald ash borer. That's a whole other show.
Yeah.
But we have someone coming in to teach us how to actually weave those baskets from ash.
So, and you have options, if I'm not mistaken, for people who can't attend the entire conference. You've got some flexibility.
We do. Yeah, we have a couple of things. First of all, the sort of kickoff evening, which is the Tuesday, February 20th, is our kickoff social and our very brief WWA annual membership meeting. So we invite anybody who's interested in learning more about the Wisconsin Wetlands Association to come out for that. It's free and open to the public and at that same Oneida Convention Center and Hotel. And then we also, historically, we've had a banquet that you and I have talked about, and we have dispensed with that this year in exchange for a more inclusive, more networking-friendly kind of event. So we're going to be having a barn dance and various other activities that will provide more opportunities for our guests and attendees to interact with one another. You know, the banquets were fabulous. But really, you talk to the one person on either side of you at your table, and then you listen to somebody for about an hour. So it wasn't our people were hankering for some more interactivity. So that's why we're going to try something new this year. It also means that more people can come because a banquet is not a cheap thing to put on.
Yeah.
And we were also aware of the fact that we were excluding some folks from that experience because of the price. So we have something else there. But the other opportunity for folks who don't want to attend in person, we offer an on-demand registration option. We host an in-person conference, but we got good at putting together recordings of presentations and whatnot during the pandemic when we did hold the conference online. So we make all of those presentations available as recordings. And if you can sign up for that and listen to all of those presentations without having to leave the comfort of your own room.
Nelson Hamm, I want to turn to you. And just a reminder, Nelson's a professor of geology and environmental science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. And you'll be presenting at the conference, Nelson. You'll talk about the last ice age and geological events that happened thousands of years ago. How does knowing the history of our wetlands improve our understanding of the state's landscape today?
Well, that's a great question. I actually have two things I'm going to talk about in one presentation that really focus on the connections between wetland science and glacial geology, so the Ice Age geology of the state. One of those things is going to be what I call kind of the wetland-glacial landform association or connection between those two. And it turns out that there's a very strong tie between those 5 million acres of wetlands that are still preserved today and the 10 million acres that existed before we started to drain wetlands starting in the mid-1800s. There's a very strong connection between the distribution and the types of wetlands and the type of glacial landscapes that they're in. What I think is fascinating is if you look at some of the oldest maps that were created showing wetlands in Wisconsin, and I'm thinking of one in my head right now from 1915, a glacial geologist looking at that map immediately would recognize the relationship between where most of those wetlands are and where the ice age, where the ice sheet advanced into and retreated from in Wisconsin. So to give you an idea, we have the least amount of wetlands in the Driftless area of southwest Wisconsin, which I'm sure many of your viewers have heard of. That really hilly region was, as far as we know, never glaciated. At least during the last couple of ice ages for sure, and it's had a long period of stream erosion that's taking place. And so for those of you that have driven, let's say, along the lower Wisconsin River Valley or any other part of the Driftless area, have noticed that most of that landscape is in the form of hillsides. So relatively small flat tops, relatively flat river bottoms, but the rest is really in slope, and that really good drainage is what prevents the formation of wetlands. On the other hand, if you're looking at the northern half of the state and the eastern half of the state, as a glacial geologist, if you compared that to an ice age map of Wisconsin, you would see the really obvious relationship between the two. The glacial landscape basically created the depressions in the landscape to create wetlands in places where the water table would have intersected those low points. And it's really kind of a fascinating thing to look at, and we're going to be looking at some of the most recent information on the glacial geology of the state and on wetland mapping to kind of show some specific examples of those relationships.
Pretty cool. How long ago was the late Ice Age, I guess we could call it, that you referenced? I know you're referencing in your talks.
Sure. The last glaciation is actually called the Wisconsin glaciation throughout North America, believe it or not. So it's not just in our state that we use that term. They use it in Canada. They use it in other states around the United States. It's known as the Wisconsin glaciation mainly because in the 1800s, one of the early really famous glacial geologists of Wisconsin, T.C. Chamberlain, for which Chamberlain Hall is named on the campus, right? Basically did some of the really first detailed look at the glacial geology of the state and also proposed names that we would use to describe things, and the Wisconsin glaciation became the defining name for the last ice age. So a good question is, well, how long ago was that? It's complicated in the sense that the ice sheet that grew out of Canada during the last ice age and advanced through the Great Lakes into Wisconsin, it didn't just make one big pass into the state and then melted out of the state, never to come back. It was a really dynamic kind of environment where it made advances and then it retreated and then it advanced again. And that took place over almost a 15,000-year span, so probably starting around 30,000 years ago and just a little bit younger than about 15,000 years ago. We had glaciers affecting the state for that 15,000-plus-year window.
That's a long time.
That's a long time
ago. Oh, my goodness me. Well, I tell you, I've got some more questions, a lot more questions for you, and I know we got Chris in Milwaukee with a question and others as well. But and I know Clara Neipert, our producer, is just dying to learn more. She was so excited about having you talk about the Two Creeks Buried Forest, and I know we're going to get to that as well. And we'll make that a little tease. We'll learn more about the Two Creeks Buried Forest, which has international excitement about. And we'll talk some more about the conference with our two guests, Katie Belfus and Nelson Hamm. And, of course, we'll take your questions as well. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Katie Belfus and Nelson Hamm. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the geologic formation of wetlands and the upcoming Wetland Science Conference with our two guests, Nelson Hamm, Professor of Geology and Environmental Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Nelson will be presenting at this year's conference about the formation of wetlands. And back with us, been with us many times, over many a year, I think. Katie Belfus is the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Always great to have her come by, too. Have you attended a wetland conference before? Questions about wetlands or about the conference? Hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Chris in Milwaukee's been waiting a bit, so let's just go to Chris for Chris's thoughts. Hi, Chris.
Well, hello. I'm glad you're bringing this subject up. If we had conservation and civics taught in grade school like it was when I was a kid 90 years ago, they would have a better understanding of why it's so important. But you bring to mind that just about 30 years ago, there was a terrible battle for the wetlands. Adams County does not have any rules as far as the land, and Columbia County does. Well, Nestle's, Perrier Nestle's from Switzerland, that does not allow drilling for water in their country, came over and they bought 20 acres of land in Adams County. And then they proceeded to think they could drain the swamp. Well, on the other side of the road was Columbia County, and my father had given me 160 acres of wetland years ago, and he said, don't ever sell it or drain it. It's for the future. Well, water doesn't stop at a road. We sued them, and they brought their big boys over from Switzerland to battle it. And thanks to Ed Garvey and Arlene and Hiroshi Okano and my good brother-in-law and sister Don and Anita Nelson, we got the Republicans and the Democrats and the born-again Christians and the atheists in Adams County and Columbia County to forget about their differences. We all needed the water.
Oh, what my a story. Gosh.
Chris, that's quite a story. She brings up all kinds of different points here, though. Chris, thanks for calling.
Well, you're absolutely right, Chris, that water does not obey our political boundaries, and that's so important. And so much of Wisconsin Wetlands Association work these days is really trying to get folks to look at the watershed, because as you said, Chris, what happens in one across one side of the road or one side of the political boundary affects everything around it. And so the same goes with conservation and protection of wetlands. We need to look at what's happening in the entire watershed rather than just take a sort of opportunistic postcard, postage stamp approach to conservation. So that's really where our work is moving. And happy to say that our laws have tightened up a little bit in the last 50 years, and lots of counties are doing terrific work on behalf of wetlands, and we're trying to facilitate that.
Yeah, it was a good story, Chris. Mm-hmm. Thank you for telling us about it. Nelson Hamm, I want to turn back to you because Clara Nyper would just hit me over the head with a book or something if I didn't get to you to talk about the Two Creeks Buried Forest, which is part of your presentation at the Wetlands Conference. Right. Geologically, what's special about this present-day state natural area?
That's a great question, and we have to do this for Clara for sure. I'll say first that the Two Creeks Buried Forest has been known by geologists for over a century, but is probably far less known to other people around the state, but I know there would be great interest in it. And the fascinating thing is that it really, to understand what that forest what the significance is, means that you have to also draw in your knowledge from wetland science. And so this is just another example of a connection. So formally, it's a state natural area that's close to the tiny little town of Two Creeks, just north of Point Beach State Park. North of two rivers. And it's along the lakeshore. That little site preserves a part of the lake bluff. The story goes that at the turn of the last century, a geologist who was walking the shoreline, mapping old raised shorelines of Lake Michigan, saw a bunch of logs and stumps sticking out of the bluff well below the ground surface. So we're talking 10 or 20 feet below the surface. And even at that time, he recognized that must have represented a forest that was growing in northeast Wisconsin before the last advance of ice into the northeast part of the state. And so essentially what happened was around 13 to 14,000 years ago, and remember, I told you that the glacier was very dynamic in the state. It would come and go and come and go. The ice retreated out of northeast Wisconsin, and the very first ice age forest began to grow in thousands of years because it was much, much colder before that time. So basically, he was seeing the remnants of this ice age forest, and you could also see the soil zone. That was all very exciting, and he interpreted it in general correctly. Since that time, there have been many, many studies of that site, but that same buried wood has been found at many sites throughout northeast Wisconsin. And when, for example, a new road is being constructed, or most recently I saw a spectacular exposure of the trees in the Outagamie County landfill. When they were opening up a new cell, they had to excavate out, you know, a certain amount of dirt, and just by chance and lucky for us, they stopped in the excavation right about the level of where those buried logs are. And so it's really fascinating. So to go back, Goldthwaite first, as a geologist, found these logs and stumps. He recognized what it was. And then in the subsequent studies, people recognized that, for example, one thing is that most of the logs came from black spruce trees. And black spruce is not a particularly common tree in Wisconsin, even though we do have some. Where black spruce dominates the landscape is essentially the boreal forest that extends from one side of Canada all the way to the other and also covers all of central Alaska. So if you've got your thinking cap on in terms of what the significance of that is, basically a forest was here that was adapted to the cold conditions at the time. And then after the ice age, after the ice left the state, other tree species and plants and animals that are adapted more to our modern climate started to recolonize Wisconsin. That boreal forest basically left the state and was migrating to the north. and eventually basically covered most of Canada and Alaska. And that was kind of the significance of the site. Like I said, it's actually well-known in glacial geology circles. And even people from other countries around the world who are glacial geologists make a trip sometime to Wisconsin just to see this exposure. It's a fascinating spot. So what's the wetland connection? The wetland connection is really interesting. Not only are the trees preserved, but you often see the preserved forest floor. So maybe 6 to 8 to 12 inches of spruce needles and pieces of bark, even pieces of insects that lived on the forest floor. And in many places, people have also found moss, the mosses that were growing on the wet forest floor.
Wow.
Really perfectly, almost perfectly preserved, you know, in that layer. Those people who have looked at those mosses really carefully and also that soil zone have said that in many places, this was a forest that also was adjacent to wetlands. Mm-hmm. And in particular, which is kind of unusual, a type of wetland called a fen, which is basically a wetland where the water that's in the landscape, the groundwater that's percolating up, has a lot of dissolved minerals in it, and you usually get a really rich, diverse ecological environment in those cases. And so it really tells us not only when the glacier last re-advanced into the state, it tells us something about the wetland landscape that existed throughout northeast Wisconsin at the time.
Fascinating.
That is really fascinating.
History on the land. I love it.
History on the land. Boy, that's a great story, and I'm sure you're going to be expanding on that.
Can't wait to hear more.
At the conference, for sure. So thanks so much for giving. And now Clara will be happy with me.
Good.
Oh, my gosh. Katie, maybe you could talk. There are other presenters as well before we go back to the phones.
Yeah, well, our other keynote session happening the following day, Nelson's speaking on Wednesday, and the Thursday keynote is actually going to be a trio of folks who are going to talk together in a little bit more informal kind of a dialogue. We have Dr. Robert Howe, who was the founder of the Cochran Center for Biodiversity at UW-Green Bay, Dr. Mandy Bennett, who's the new director, who because Robert has retired, and Amy Wolf, who's a professor at UW-Green Bay. And the three of them are going to engage in a conversation about the past in the area, what's happened to wetlands around Green Bay, what's happening now, and what can we look forward to in the future, and doing a little bit of a virtual tour of some of the coastal wetlands in the area as well. So really looking forward to that presentation. And then, of course, there's something like 45 other talks being given by folks from across the state about work that they're doing and things they're researching.
In case I forget to do this later, how do people, if they wanted to sign up or participate, how do you do that?
Yep, you go to conference.wisconsinwetlands.org, and you can find all of the information there, including information about how to get registered. And you got to register by February 15th because that's when we got to start making name tags and stuff. So.
Oh, okay. So
you got 2 weeks. That's good.
Still got 2 weeks, but I wouldn't wait. I just probably better to do it now than later, for sure. Don in Bayfield County has something for us. Don, hi.
Hey, I got really lucky when I bought my land up here. I have no neighbors because all the property around me is designated DNR wetlands. Mosquitoes are great, and so are the frogs.
Well, Don got lucky.
That's a beautiful part of the state, and some very important wetlands, actually, up in Door County. I'm sorry, we're Bayfield County. I'm confused. There are also very important wetlands in Bayfield County. I apologize. There's some one of our Ramsar wetlands of international importance. We have six here in the state of Wisconsin. One of them is the Cocagan and Bad River sloughs that's up in Bayfield County, where the Cocagan River and Bad River empty into Lake Superior. Well, Shawamigan Bay, actually, but, you know, eventually Lake Superior.
Don, you're in a good place. I've got some property in Bayfield County. I'm with you. I like it a lot there. Speaking of that area of the state, Ralph in Hayward emailed us and wonders, when does a wetland become something else by definition? For example, is there an extended period of drought and wetland dries up absent of any human manipulation, without any human manipulation? Is the land recategorized? In a nutshell, what are the legitimate reasons or markers for recategorizing what has been a wetland?
Interesting question. Well, to answer that question, first I'm going to sort of rewind and talk about how the regulators define wetlands. You know, we at Wetlands Association like to say wetlands are the places between the always dry places and the always wet places. And then the regulators, of course, have to get a little bit more specific than that. And so they look for three factors. The presence of soil types that develop under wet conditions, because the soils are very different if they've developed under those conditions. Plants that are adapted to live in wet conditions. And the presence of water at or near the surface of the ground for all or part of a year. So wetlands are very dynamic, right? There's a lot of flexibility in that. And so when there's a, you know, the mapping is mostly done based on the soils because those are the things that are the most constant, right? Plants are a little bit more variable. And water, certainly, as you point out, there's dry years and wet years, so that can be a little more variable. But the soils are more steady. So that's generally the sort of starting place when you're mapping out where wetlands are. And when you need to get a permit for something, for some activity that will require a wetland delineation, somebody will come out and look for the soils and the water and the plants. And if you're there at a time of year where the water's not there, because it might be September and maybe that's when it's a dry time of year in that particular area, they could still see the soil and they can still see the plants. And that is when you would determine if there was a change. But usually it's something pretty fundamental has got to have changed because most of that stuff doesn't change very rapidly. The change is on a bigger order of magnitude in terms of time scale than I think we would see in our lifetime. But that's sort of a blink of the process that would happen in order to redesignate an area.
And he was talking about the sort of natural occurrences. Jeff in Delafield had also wondered about drain tiles, use of drain tiles in agricultural fields. How is that impacting wetlands? And mentions he's also grateful for the work of the Wetlands Association.
Oh, well, first, thank you, Jeff. That's very lovely of you to say. We are grateful and hope you're a member. And so getting back to his question about drain tile is one of the biggest ways that some kinds of wetlands have been drained. Those sedge meadows are in some of the most common types that were drained in this way. They were the easiest to drain for when we wanted more land for agriculture. So often the drain tile was in fact put into areas that would have been wetlands and then were subsequently able to be cropped because the water was being moved off. So the fundamental impact is right away, right? That's not a wetland anymore and you're farming it. And the good news is that the drain tiles in many cases can be removed, and with other work, those areas can be restored to wetland if that's in the landowner's in interest, if that's their goal. The other impact I will say from drain tiles is that it takes that water that would have sort of percolated down into the ground across a large extent of that field, concentrates it in these little pipes, and dumps it somewhere into a stream down slope, and you're taking water that would have been spread out over a large area and putting it in a very small pipe and then dumping it somewhere, and so it makes the water go into the stream a lot faster than it would have normally, and it brings with it whatever it runs into, whether that's chemicals or soil or whatever else. So a lot of times we see nitrogen challenges in streams where there's a lot of drain tile. And I'm not pointing a finger of blame at agriculture. It's just the way that we use, that's what happens, right? The water gets concentrated. And there are ways that we can manage that challenge that involve creating some buffers or restoring wetlands in strategic locations.
And the drain tiles have been removed.
Yeah.
Yep. In Wisconsin.
Yes, they have in many places. In fact, I talked with one landowner up near Two Rivers, actually, who had removed 5 layers of drain tile from his land. So vertically, right, there were 5 layers. And the oldest one, it took me a while to get my brain around, the oldest one was at the top, closest to the surface, And the newest one was at the bottom. And I was like, how does that? But you think about it, you drain a little bit and then some water, you need to get more effective, you put it lower. And then you need to get more effective, you put it lower. Because sometimes when you drain these hydric soils, they start to decompose. And so that the soil volume actually reduces as it breaks down and the surface can sink. And so he had five layers of tile that he had to pull out. And the top ones, the oldest ones, you had fingerprints in the clay tile because they were handmade. Somebody had made them and like stuck them on top of their wood stove to dry them out, right? Amazing amount of effort to drain these wetlands.
And good to have it back into its
absolutely
natural condition.
Yep.
Nelson, I want to go back to you for just a minute. What do you hope conference attendees will take away from your presentation?
Well, I think a lot of things that are at least a theme that we've been focusing on with some even writings in the newsletter for the WWA this past year is fully understanding the connections between wetlands, for example, and other aspects of the landscape. And the really cool thing about working with wetland scientists is they have just as much of a passion for understanding Wisconsin's landscapes as someone like me, who's a glacial geologist. And so it's always the case when I work with them or I talk with them that they are simply like a sponge wanting to know as much as they can about the glacial geology. And the reverse for me is I think the kind of work that they do is really informative in the opposite direction. And so it's the connection that I think we're gonna focus on.
Oh, that's really cool. And Katie, back to you again for the conference. I do want to get a little reminder about what's going on there again and when.
Yep. So the conference is February 20th to 22nd in Green Bay at the Oneida Hotel and Convention Center. And you can find out all the information at conference.wisconsinwetlands.org, including a link to registration. I wanted to shout out again that the Tuesday, February 20th, there's an opportunity to attend the Wisconsin Wetlands Association annual membership meeting. You don't need to be a member to attend. We invite everybody. It's free and open to the public, also at that same Oneida Hotel and Convention Center. And you can learn more about that on our website, wisconsinwetlands.org.
And Nelson is speaking when?
Wednesday morning.
Wednesday morning. Oh,
February 21st.
Early Wednesday morning.
That's right.
Bright and early, yeah. Wednesday morning. What time, actually?
That's a good question. I think it's 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. Well, don't be late, Nelson.
He's going to come party the night before. Who knows? Yeah, he lives in the area, so it's easy for him.
Listen, thanks so much. To both of you today. You know, the conference is always great. I know your talk, Nelson, is going to be super. You probably have a few visuals to go along with it.
A lot of visuals. I'm going to focus a lot on the landforms in terms of what we've learned in the past 40 years of really detailed glacial geology mapping and also new techniques for measuring the shape of the Earth's surface, laser techniques that have supplanted the old topographic maps.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you again both very much for being with us. Katie Belfast is the Outreach Program Director at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And Nelson Hamm is Professor of Geology and Environmental Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. And presenting at this year's conference. It's always great to have Katie come by. Nelson, it was great to have him with us as well. And great to have you listening in. And let me tell you, tomorrow on the show, we've got some representatives from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We always talk about consumer complaints. And you'll have a chance to call in if you've got a question or a comment or an experience. And they will be telling us their top 10 complaints that they received this past year. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.